funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, trucks loaded with bombs explode in central Istanbul. Among the dead, Britain's consul general. Prime Minister Blair vows to press on with Washington in the war on terrorism.
This is a time to show strength, determination, and complete resolve. This terrorism is the 21st century threat.
Protesters greet President Bush in London, while in Miami, 10,000 rally against free trade talks.
Also, with the mutual fund industry under scrutiny, we'll offer tips for investors.
These stories and the reissue of two groundbreaking documentaries on JFK, coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair are condemning today's bombings in Istanbul, which have killed at least 26 people and injured more than 400. Speaking in London, President Bush said the terrorists are hoping to intimidate and demoralize, but they're not going to succeed. And Blair said such actions only increase the determination to wipe out terrorism wherever it occurs.
You're not going to stop these people by trying to compromise with them, by hesitating in the face of this menace. It's defeat them or be defeated by them. And that's what we're going to do.
Trucks packed with explosives blew up at the British consulate and at a London-based bank in Istanbul. Reporter Dorian Jones says the bombs caused massive damage.
The entrance to the British consulate, and British consulate is surrounded by a very large wall and has two small buildings, one for security and one for reception. Both those buildings have been destroyed. They are just piles of rubble. Several cars surrounding the entrance have been gutted by fire, and a small truck, has been completely destroyed, obliterated, just the wheels and the chassis remaining. Lots of buildings have lost all their windows. There's been a lot of damage done to surrounding buildings. Glass is everywhere. Many people have been injured by flying glass, and similar scenes have been reported from the site of the second bombing outside the HSBC Bank building.
Reporter Dorian Jones in Istanbul. Today's explosions are fueling anti-war demonstrations in London. Tens of thousands are marching to protest President Bush's visit, as well as U.S. and British policies in Iraq. One demonstrator says today's attacks are exactly what protesters had predicted would happen if the U.S. and Britain invaded Iraq. Demonstrators are also out in the streets of Miami, but they're marching against the proposed 34-nation free trade area of the Americas. NPR's Philip Davis has that story.
The protesters carried puppets, signs, banners, and banged on drums to express their opposition to a proposed Free Trade Area of the Americas, or FTAA, which would lower trade barriers for 34 countries in the Western Hemisphere. Protesters were accompanied by nearly as many police, as law enforcement officials dialed in a massive presence on foot, on bicycle, and with many equipped with riot gear. Though there were fears of violence all week long, the march has been, in the main, peaceful, though about a dozen marchers resisted when police tried to change their route, and some officers were seen with red paint on their visors. Meanwhile, negotiators at the FTAA conference said a free trade deal now being circulated will be much reduced in scope from its original intent, allowing countries to opt out of certain trade provisions if they so choose. Philip Davis, NPR News, Miami.
On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials are down 5 points to 96.85 in moderate trade. The Nasdaq's up 10 to 19.09, and the S&P 500 is down a fraction. You're listening to NPR News. In NPR's business update, the closely watched index of leading economic indicators rose 0.4% in October. The private research firm, the Conference Board, says the data point to continued economic growth in the next year. The index is designed to predict economic activity 3 to 6 months down the road. Abercrombie and Fitch is facing another lawsuit, claiming the company discriminates against minorities who want jobs in its clothing stores. This latest suit was filed in Camden, New Jersey. It's similar to one filed in San Francisco last June. From member station WBGO, Doug Doyle reports.
The latest suit claims Abercrombie and Fitch hires white college students for its sales positions, but tends to hire minorities for behind-the-scenes jobs like overnight shifts and stockroom work. The lead plaintiff in this latest lawsuit applied for a job at a Cherry Hill Mall store. Brandy Hawk was initially told by an assistant manager she would be recommended for the job, but was later rejected. Hawk says she was told she didn't fit the image the retailer wanted to project. The lawsuit seeks class action status. Abercrombie and Fitch would not comment on the case. In the California case, the clothes seller denied the claims and said it wants a diverse workforce. For NPR News, I'm Doug Doyle in Newark.
Boeing has delivered the first 737s with blended wingtips to Southwest Airlines. The curved wingtips increase range and fuel efficiency and cause less noise at takeoff. Southwest says it expects each plane will save 92,000 gallons of fuel a year. The airline plans to install the wings on 170 of its planes over the next 18 months. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, now in its 25th year.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Sounds of the aftermath of terror in Istanbul, Turkey this morning as truck bombs devastated the headquarters of a British bank and the British consulate, killing the British consul general and at least two dozen others. As many as 400 are injured. Violence just hours before a scheduled press conference in London between President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Both leaders said the attacks only stiffened their resolve. Here's Prime Minister Blair.
There must be no holding back, no compromise, no hesitation in confronting this menace, in attacking it wherever and whenever we can, and in defeating it utterly.
Joining me on the line now from Istanbul is Christian Science Monitor reporter Eileen Prusher. Hi, Eileen.
Hi.
Eileen, paint me a picture, if you would, of the scene in central Istanbul.
Well, I would say that central Istanbul earlier today was really a scene of mayhem. It almost felt like a war zone. There were a lot of people running around quite hysterically, a lot of injured people, waiting for treatment. It's not something that happens very often in Turkey. So people were really in a state of shock, and even the police and ambulance services seemed to be really grasping with how to handle it. Now things, of course, are cordoned off and a little bit calmer, but I wouldn't say nerves are really calmer, and Turks are really trying to come to terms with the arrival of terrorism on their soil, which used to be a domestic issue in the past and was never really an international issue and hasn't been one in quite a few years.
The shock, of course, compounded by those bombings at synagogues over the weekend in which 23 died. Now, Al-Qaeda claimed credit for the bombings over the weekend. What are we hearing about who may have done this?
Well, there hasn't been a definite ID yet on who has done this. We've heard that there might have been some claims from different radical groups taking responsibility for it, but that also happened on Saturday, so it seems that we don't want to say for certain yet. But what we can say is that the sophistication of the attacks, the fact that they took place almost simultaneously in different parts of the city just after 11 o'clock this morning, it really does show that whoever has launched these attacks really had very good information and good coordination. And that's definitely a disturbing moment for the Turkish police and the government to come to grips with as they try to figure out not just who was responsible for Saturday's attacks, but also today's. And going forward, there's a fear that this might not be the worst of it.
Well, Eileen, to finish up, a sense of greater security in the streets after the synagogue bombings. Will there be greater security now? What do Turks think about their security in Istanbul?
Well, it's true. This attack actually gives a sense that things are, the violence is certainly very random now, and we actually didn't see that great of a difference after the synagogue attacks. I mean, there were some security forces out, but they seemed to be protecting certain targets. There was a fear that perhaps Christian targets could be hit, such as Greek or Armenian churches. You know, now we're seeing a sense that the Turkish government will certainly come out in force and increase the level of security. But I think more important than that is probably going to be the intelligence to try to figure out exactly who was involved and what the level of Turkish cooperation was, because it's been very easy for the government to say this is an international attack from Al-Qaeda. But in fact, it couldn't have been carried out, neither Saturday's attacks nor today's, without very good cooperation from some individuals in Turkey itself.
Eileen Prusher is a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke to us from Istanbul, Turkey. Eileen, thanks so much.
Thanks, Bill.
Well, we turn now to Andrew Hess, director of the Turkish Studies Program at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you.
Andrew, this is the second bombing in a week in Turkey. One commentator we spoke to about the bombings at two synagogues over the weekend in which 23 died, he said it was Turkey's 9/11. Now this, Al-Qaeda took credit for the synagogue bombings. It's believed responsible for this. Has Al-Qaeda support in Turkey?
We're not really sure. The Ministry of Interior people seem to think that the Turkish group, the IBDAC, it has various terms at times, is a very small organization and may just simply be getting into the act along with Al-Qaeda in some fashion. Whether or not there's a long-running, deep connection between the two is just not clear.
Yeah. Many Turks, as you know, are very interested in stronger ties with Europe and the West, and yet many Turks also oppose the war in Iraq. There are conflicts in the Turkish soul right now in this Islamic country, right?
Oh, yes, very much so. And a lot is riding on how the government officials react to these events. There's some indication from what Prime Minister Erdogan said after the bombings of the synagogues, in the sense that he condemned them vigorously as attacks on Turkish citizens. So he's taken a stance that's along the line of what Turkey has been doing with Europe and with the United States. But will that appeal to all of the people that in his political party? That's another question.
Yes, Prime Minister Erdogan is a deeply devout Muslim. Many concerned in Turkey, this long secular state, when such a devout Muslim was made prime minister. Could this create a backlash against Erdogan or against Islamists in Turkey?
I think that what will probably happen is that the Turkish establishment will rally around Kemalist position.
Kemalist position meaning the traditional secular approach.
That's right. And many of the followers of his own party are moderates, really, not radicals. And they will support this because they've seen that the radical action is not in line with their Muslim values.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the military always a factor in Turkey. What do you think?
They're going to be very worried about the situation on Turkey's frontier with Iraq because any weakening of the current regime in Turkey may encourage the radicals among the Kurds to adopt a more militant position and will have a revival maybe of Kurdish violence in that region.
Andrew, is Turkey any more vulnerable to this kind of attack than anywhere else? We know that even as security-conscious a state as Israel is unable to prevent these attacks. How is security in Turkey?
Well, Turkey's had long experience with this this kind of violence, and it has also had experience with the Kurdish national violence. So I would think that although this is a terrible blot on the record for the intelligence and the police community, that they will redouble their efforts to prevent anything like this happening in the future, and they will ally themselves even more thoroughly with the interests of the United States and other countries in the war against terrorism.
Another dynamic at play in this, Andrew, is Turkey's long friendly relationship, both economically and strategically, with Israel.
Yes, I think that's going to be reinforced by this affair. I think the Turks will not tolerate radical disruption of their politics by a small group of religious extremists.
the radicalism behind these bombings does not reflect the vast majority of Turks?
Of course not.
Simple as that.
Yep.
Andrew Hess is a professor of diplomacy at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thank you.
Freedom of speech! Freedom of speech!
The sound of a massive march slowly wending its way into the heart of London, protesting President Bush's policies today. The demonstration comes as news of the devastating attacks on British interests in Turkey also filters through the city. Speaking earlier today, President Bush said he wasn't fazed by the protests, and the attacks made him more determined than ever.
Great Britain, America, and other free nations are united today in our grief and united in our determination to fight and defeat this evil wherever it is found.
Joining us from the site of the march in London is WBUR's Michael Goldfarb. Michael, paint the picture for us.
Well, right now, Robin, I'm standing just by the side of the Church of St. Martin in the Fields, which overlooks Trafalgar Square. Speeches are still going on, and this is to and froing of traffic. Some people who've been on the march are leaving, and others are just arriving. It was quite a long procession. And they pulled down a statue of George Bush, kind of to echo the pulling down of the statue of Saddam Hussein in Baghdad back in April.
Mm. Well, Michael, for the last few days, we've been hearing conflicting reports about the strength of opposition to Bush and U.S. policies in Britain. We hear that the crowd, the march, had as many as 50,000 people. Was that as big as projected?
Well, I wouldn't take any count quite yet. The march was filtering along at quite a pace over the course of the afternoon. Initially, people thought there'd be about 100,000. If official estimates are 50,000, split the difference. That's what I say.
Yeah.
I think that this march doesn't quite match where we were in February before the war. This is a march that started at the University of London, passed the London School of Economics, and then passed King's College London, picking up students along the way. So it's hard to say. I mean, I think that people have, as throughout this whole thing with Iraq, there's an enormous sense of resentment. But then the event happens, and many people just kind of stay at home and ignore it.
Well, Michael, how about the attacks this morning against British interests in Turkey? Can you tell if that's at all muted people's protests today?
I don't think it had any effect. In fact, Robin, the number of people I asked on the march and what they thought of the attack in Istanbul, I was often the bearer of bad tidings. They had been out and about, not near any news media, and so I was the first one to tell them about it. I think that broadly, there's a unanimity of opinion among people that what do you expect? That this is almost an inevitable consequence of going to war in Iraq, that you will find an upsurge in Islamic militancy, and Britain is now as big a target as the United States.
Hmm. And yet others are saying that others in Britain might say that the fact that British interests were a target are going to mobilize support for Bush and Blair's anti-terrorist stance. Do you get any feeling of that, perhaps not at the march, but just in general?
I think that just as my own general view, having, you know, been involved covering a variety of conflicts in which terrorism is part of the picture, is that often while acts of terrorism will in some ways excite adherence of a cause, they often, you know, make civil society stiffen and resent the people who perpetrate these things even more. So it's still very early days to say what effect this bombing will have, although it should also be said, Robin, that over the last few decades, the people on this island have had experience of terrorism through the IRA, and so, you know, they have a different approach to dealing with the shocking news.
And Michael, just in a couple seconds, what's next for President Bush in London?
Robin, I've got a police helicopter hovering right over me now.
Well,
could you ask that question louder?
Well, as a matter of fact, we're going to let you go and let you attend to business there at the march. Michael, thank you so much.
All right, thanks.
WBUR's Michael Goldfarb with helicopters hovering above him. He spoke to us from the protests in London.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, protests in this country, too, this morning. Police are blanketing downtown Miami as officers and demonstrators clash near the site of talks on creating a free trade zone for North and South America. Amy Driscoll is covering the story for the Miami Herald and just returned from the site of the protests. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you.
Amy, how big is the demonstration?
Well, it's a little hard to tell at this point. We have several thousand protesters in the streets right now, but these are protesters who are not part of any formal march. They are various affinity groups, anarchists, different kinds of groups, and so it's a little bit difficult to get a number, a hard number on them, because they are all over the streets of downtown Miami right now.
Clashes with police, or is it more of a quiet atmosphere? What's the scene?
No, there are a lot of clashes with police. They've used pepper gas and the batons. Several people have gone to the hospital. We're expecting some more of that because they are trying desperately to get into the area where the FTAA is being held. There's a big fence around that.
Now, what do the protesters want?
Well, they are anti-globalization in general. Some of them are anti-capitalist as well. Some of them are more mainstream, though. They are the members of the AFL-CIO are also protesting today, because they think that the FTAA will cause a decrease in the number of jobs in the United States.
By the way, I've just been handed a dispatch. AP is now estimating the protesters in Miami at about 1,000. Amy, what was expected from the free trade agreement? A free trade agreement from Alaska to Argentina?
Well, I think that they were hoping to have an agreement. I think that they've made a few steps so far in that direction. But it's far from a done deal, and so the protesters are hoping that this is a leverage point for them.
Amy, you live in Miami. I lived there for a number of years. Does something like this anger average people more than anything else, do you think? Traffic is bad enough in Miami. This will have made it even worse today?
Yes, I think that they've alienated an awful lot of commuters today, both by the FTAA and the protesters. Most of the streets in downtown are shut down at various points. It's difficult to tell which ones will be shut down at what time. All public transportation has been suspended, which is also really hard. There are a lot of people walking the streets who did not expect to be walking today.
Mm-hmm. Just very briefly, Amy, are the protests expected to go on much longer?
Yes, in fact, we're in the middle of a standoff right now. These are the sort of freelance protesters who are out there right now. There's a permitted march, a march with a permit that starts at 2 o'clock, and that one is supposed to be somewhere between 10 and 20,000 people.
Amy Driscoll is a reporter with the Miami Herald. Thanks so much for joining us, Amy.
Thank you.
How does the mainland of Europe view President Bush's visit to Britain this week? And how does the apparent bomb campaign against Turkey, a country looking to join the European Union, change anything? The U.S. is shopping around a new U.N. resolution on Iraq and a tough new stance on Iran's nuclear program. And what Europe thinks matters. Joining us on the line from Brussels, Belgium, is Thomas Klau, bureau chief of the German Financial Times. Welcome.
Hello.
We're also joined from Washington, D.C. by Anatole Levin, senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Welcome, Anatole.
Hello.
Let's talk first briefly about public opinion in Europe. There's been much criticism in the past of Bush policies. Do you think this morning's bombings in Turkey will have any impact on that criticism? Thomas, you're in Brussels. What do you think?
Well, I mean, that attack proves two things, doesn't it? That it's that Bush and Blair are absolutely right to say that terrorism is a major threat which is confronting the West. The other lesson a lot of people draw, I think, from it is that the decision to go to war against Saddam Hussein has not really decreased the terrorist threat.
Well, Anatole, from your perch at a think tank in Washington, D.C., what does it matter whether Britain and the rest of Europe agree totally on U.S. policies in Iraq?
Well, Britain has 10,000 troops in Iraq. If British public opinion were to become so hostile to this operation that the British government had to withdraw them, then that could lead to a collapse of the entire American-led operation, or it could lead to the deployment of more American troops in Iraq, which America simply doesn't have. But the second thing is, America desperately needs help elsewhere in the Middle East, for example, in the attempt to stop Iran getting weapons of mass destruction. And for that, it has to have the Europeans on its side. A unilateral American approach to Iran hasn't worked for many years, and there's no reason to think that it will work in future.
I want to ask about the role of Turkey in this discussion of European, U.S., and British relations. It seems as if it's playing a larger role just because of this week's campaign. What role does Turkey play in all of this?
Well, Turkey plays an absolutely critical role in Iraq by virtue of its geographical position. But secondly, it's Turkey rather than Iraq or Afghanistan which has the real hope of emerging as a sort of model of democracy and progress in the Muslim world.
Mm. And Thomas?
My guess would be, although it's probably too early to say, that the recent spate of bomb attacks in Istanbul will probably strengthen rather than weaken the Turkish government and the Turkish political establishment's determination to move westwards and to integrate with the EU.
And Thomas, as Turkey moves closer to joining the EU, will it then be an ally of, let's say, the British-US camp as opposed to the French-German camp?
Well, Turkey has shown repeatedly how uncomfortable it was with the American-British approach to Iraq. It was very uncomfortable with the invasion.
But on the other hand, it's now been a target of bombings.
It's a target of bombings. But again, you know, I'd say that that it's one thing to support the American-British stance on terrorism, but Iraq is a different issue. And the skepticism many felt in Europe about supporting the war in Iraq has now increased tenfold. And Turkey, I don't think Turkey's analysis will be very different.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you both.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thomas Klau, Brussels Bureau Chief for the German edition of the Financial Times. Anatole Lieven, Senior Fellow with the Carnegie Endowment of International Peace.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, Priscilla McMillan, said to be the only person who knew both John F. Kennedy and his assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald.
Also, gay marriage in Massachusetts, Rush Limbaugh on the radio, that and more on our editorial roundtable. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, wanted for arrest, pop star Michael Jackson.
And people are taking money out of their 401ks. One money manager says that's not a good idea.
I think it's a gigantic mistake to withdraw money from any retirement plan, because the second you take a dollar out of your retirement plan of any sort, it becomes instantly taxable.
And filmmaker Robert Drew, the man who documented JFK on film.
We were going to do something that had never been done before. It would be a new form of reporting, a new form of journalism.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. The Al-Qaeda terror network is claiming responsibility for what's being called one of the worst terrorist bombings in Turkey's history. Deadly truck bombs exploded in Istanbul today, killing more than 24 people and wounding some 450 others. Trucks packed with explosives blew up at the British consulate and at the local offices of a London-based bank. Among the dead is British Consul General Roger Short. British Prime Minister Tony Blair says the attacks make Britain strengthen its resolve to fight terrorism.
Our response is not to flinch or give way or concede one inch. We stand absolutely firm until this job is done. Done in Iraq, done elsewhere in the world.
President Bush, continuing his visit to Britain, appeared with Blair and vowed to stop those behind the bombings in Turkey. At least four people are reportedly dead, several more hurt after an explosion outside a Kurdish political party office in Iraq. The latest bombing comes after a string of attacks on politicians and community leaders who have cooperated with the U.S.-led coalition. A scare at the White House this morning. Officials now blame a false radar reading for prompting a partial evacuation. Some staffers, reporters, photographers fled the executive mansion after the Secret Service advised that a plane was flying close to restricted airspace. However, a Federal Aviation Administration spokesman reports when fighter jets scrambled to where the plane was supposed to be, they found nothing. A Secret Service spokeswoman stresses there was no formal evacuation order. Most people returned to the building after about 15 minutes. Police in Miami today clashed with hundreds of demonstrators who were protesting the creation of a hemisphere-wide free trade zone. Talks on the proposed 34-nation free trade of the Americas Economic Agreement are underway in Miami. Tony Winton is there.
Some protesters tried to throw some wires, guy wires, on these steel barricades to try and topple them down. That's when the tear gas came out. Two large explosions, canisters being fired. The crowd moved back several hundred feet. Officers quickly filled into the gap, and now they have formed a protective wall, keeping the protesters even further away from the meeting site.
Reporter Tony Winton in Miami. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan says expanding trade deficits have not hurt the U.S. economy, but warned against what he calls creeping protectionism that might hurt the nation's ability to narrow deficits in the future. On Wall Street today, stocks are mixed. This is Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, Michael Jackson hasn't had a big hit in years, but in case you haven't heard, in case you've been under a rock for the past 24 hours or so, Jackson himself's again very much in demand, only this time by the police. The 45-year-old King of Pops wanted on suspicion of molesting a 12-year-old boy. Joining us on the line is Associated Press reporter Brian Bland, who's outside the police station in Santa Barbara, California. Welcome, Brian.
Bill, hello to you.
Thanks for joining us, Brian. Now, this is where Michael Jackson would turn himself in, right?
Well, that's still a good question. It's been, as you mentioned, 24 hours or so since the DA and the sheriff announced that they'd issued an arrest warrant for Michael Jackson and were negotiating his surrender. Now his criminal attorney, Mark Garrigo, says that those arrangements have been made, but he declined to say where or when. And the sheriff's department and the DA, they are not saying either. So it's almost still anybody's guess. There are people at the airport, there are people at the courthouse, there are people everywhere trying to figure out where that might happen.
Brian, the police want him. Why doesn't he just isn't he compelled to just turn himself in like anybody else?
Well, this question was asked yesterday and has been asked with increasing frequency, Bill, as you might guess. If you were wanted on multiple felonies, how long would you be given to negotiate your surrender and so forth? Well, the answer where Michael Jackson is concerned seems to be at least 24 hours because he's still not in custody. He still hasn't surrendered his passport, and neither the DA nor the Sheriff's Department have ever said, in fact declined to say, how long they were extending this particular courtesy to him.
Anything more about the specific allegations today?
Nothing more specific than what we've heard already, that there are multiple counts. We were very careful to ask whether all those counts applied to just one victim. The district attorney's answer was that he was going to decline to answer that question. The sheriff, on the other hand, did call to the public to say, if there are any other victims out there, please contact us. And then the district attorney again, Tom Snedden, said that this case does involve what he called a cooperative victim. He used the singular. Whether that means all charges apply to that one person is still not clear.
Brian, just very briefly, how long could theoretically Michael Jackson go to jail?
Well, the first count of molestation, anywhere from 3 to 8 years if convicted. Each additional one, there's a whole complicated math formula, Bill, but essentially it would tack about 2 years on for each other count upon conviction.
Brian Bland reports for the Associated Press. He joined us from Santa Barbara, California. Thanks, Brian.
You bet, Bill.
Mutual fund investors used to ask what funds are hot. Now many investors are wondering what fund is not under investigation. Nearly 15 fund companies are being looked into. Some money managers have been charged with using investor money for their own personal gain. And Congress is stepping up its efforts to regulate the industry. Yesterday, the House overwhelmingly approved a bill to curb trading abuses and increase government oversight. So we ask, what's an investor to do? Joining us on the line is financial advisor John Spooner. Hi, John.
Good afternoon, Robin.
Well, first of all, do you think regulation of these mutual funds is a good idea? Will it win back some trust?
Well, I think we're in a period where the pendulum is swinging in the direction of way oversight. I mean, constant oversight as opposed to freedom of markets. And this happens periodically. We go from fear to greed and back again. So I think that we're going to see all kinds of new regulation. However, I'm not sure, looking at the mutual fund side, other than press coverage, I don't see any vast protests on the part of the public against the mutual fund industry yet.
Well, but as you point out, some feel these guys have brought it on themselves and they deserve the regulation.
Oh, no question.
Yeah, but and people are moving their money around. So that brings us to the question, how do you do that? Without saying research, how do you know where to move it?
I think that all of us have a buddy system of some sort. Talk to a friend of yours who you think has a brain and is also invested in mutual funds and their 401k and say, look, give me a couple of suggestions about where to move from one fund to another.
Well, John, you're ours.
Tell
us now, I mean, is there a specific thing? Yes, a friend can tell you mine's doing well, but then you open up the paper the next day and theirs is being investigated. What is one thing an investor can look at to get some idea of whether they're going to a good mutual fund?
Well, sometimes the biggest or the oldest are better. And Morningstar rates all the mutual funds. And it's very easy to find Morningstar online. And if you look for a highly rated Morningstar fund, chances are, in the long run, you're going to be fine with that.
Yeah. Is there a way to find out if, say, somebody who runs a fund has their money in that fund? Or, you know, some other telling ways, you know, is there a way to find out, did a CEO get a too extraordinary bonus? Are these things that you can look at?
Well, one thing you can't, it's very difficult to find out if individual managers own their own funds unless you ask. But nowhere is it going to be in print for you to find that out.
Yeah.
For instance, nobody ever asks a financial advisor, in my experience, individual financial advisor, what stocks, if any, do you own for yourself? No one ever asks that question, and the public should ask.
According to two recent Wall Street Journal articles, fewer employees are participating in their employer's 401k or retirement plans, and some are withdrawing their money. What do you think about that?
You mean withdrawing their money? Well, I think it's a gigantic mistake to withdraw money from any retirement plan, whether it's a 401k or an individual IRA, before retirement age or before you legally can take it out at 59 and a half, because the second you take a dollar out of your retirement plan of any sort, it becomes instantly taxable to you. And the second question is, what are you going to do with the money? Why would you remove it from a tax-free entity where the gains are all tax-free, the dividends are tax-free, and it accumulates until the days when you want to kick back?
Well, apparently, according to this report, what some people are doing is when they changed jobs last year voluntarily, they cashed out their savings in their one plan instead of rolling it over into their new plan.
Well, this is just an education process, and when you leave one job, there's always a human resources person who presumably guides you in what the next step might be. But I think it's a disaster to cash in a plan if you leave a job and go to the next one, as opposed to rolling it into your own still tax-free IRA that you can set up for yourself individually.
Yeah. What do you say to the people who are, we know, the large number of people who have lost their jobs and lost their unemployment and they've almost stopped looking and they just feel they have to take some of that cash out of the 401k?
In that case, you have to do what you have to do because survival is the essence. And all you can say is keep looking, don't despair, and, you know, all the platitudes that surround situations like this. But as far as withdrawing money for need, unfortunately, that's why those plans are there. You have to do what you have to do.
Yeah. John, thank you.
You bet, Robin. Thank you.
John Spooner, money manager and author of the book, Do You Want to Make Money or Would You Rather Fool Around? John spoke to us from Boston. Still to come, what were you doing 40 years ago Saturday? Filmmaker Robert Drew was documenting JFK. His films have been re-released, and we'll talk to him.
You're listening to Here and Now. It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
This week, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court ruled that gay couples should have the right to marry in the Bay State. We talked to Brian Kamenker, president of the Parents' Rights Coalition, who said most Americans oppose gay marriage. Well, that provoked Carol Gendel of North Andover, Massachusetts, to write, contrary to the beliefs of the representative from Parents' Rights, not everyone supports his bigoted stand against gay marriage. I laud the reasoned decision by the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. No one is forcing churches to perform gay ceremonies, just the state to issue licenses.
Our segment on this week's hearings on the possible release of John Hinckley, the man who shot President Reagan, for the first unsupervised visits with Hinckley's parents, prompted psychologist Peter Cohen of Massachusetts to write that Hinckley should be treated like any other psychiatric patient. We called him up for his opinion.
Well, needless to say, the behavior that he engaged in was quite heinous and frightening. But by all indication, he seems to be a pretty well-compensated psychiatric patient at this point.
But do you worry, Dr. Cohen, that he fooled the doctors once before, in fact, right before he shot at President Reagan and others?
Well, at that point, I don't think that the treating psychiatrist had adequate information to make a comprehensive assessment. Now, Mr. Hinckley has been in custody and under virtually constant observation for 20 years since that time.
Doctor, are there better ways to release a mentally ill patient who's taking medication into the public than others?
Yes, there are. And that is simply to have a structure in place to see to it that he follows up with regular scheduled visits.
Sort of like having a probation officer.
It's exactly what this is. It's a psychiatric probation.
Dr. Cohen, thank you very much.
Certainly.
Alan Kennedy of Wilmington, Delaware, wrote, responding to our discussion of the British press being censored, not allowed to print allegations of homosexual conduct between Prince Charles and his butler. Alan writes, it may be a foreign concept to an American journalist, but in Britain, you must be able to prove the truth of what you print or broadcast, or you may lose a libel suit. Get it? The truth and journalistic responsibility for assuring truthfulness are considered important there. Do you really think this is censorship?
Our segment on scary movies with film reviewers Eric Schaefer and Renee Graham brought this email from John Keller of Charlotte, North Carolina. I can't believe neither Eric nor Renee mentioned Night of the Living Dead. Cheesy, but it scared the heck out of me and my kids, too, 20 years later.
And finally, Burke Cox of Philadelphia sent this thanks for our backstage visit to the Kirov Ballet. From the tutu taco to the patch of Russian conversation at the end with accompanying musical backup, it hit the right notes. Well, Burke, many of those notes were from Stravinsky's Firebird Suite.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters at here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org.
Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please remember to include your full name, phone number, and the town where you live.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
No president has ever been filmed as intimately as John F. Kennedy, making decisions of historic importance. In June of 1963, two black students were determined to integrate the University of Alabama. The state's governor, George Wallace, vowed to prevent it. Kennedy's decision-making process in the Oval Office, his struggle to decide how to confront the explosive unfolding situation in Alabama, was filmed by Robert Drew for his documentary, Crisis, Behind a Presidential Commitment. It was Drew's second landmark film with Kennedy. His first followed the then Massachusetts senator and candidate for president in 1960, as Kennedy ran against Minnesota Senator Hubert Humphrey in the Wisconsin primary. Both documentaries were revolutionary for their time, shot on the fly on small cameras, with sound synced to what people were saying as events unfolded. Nothing like it had ever been seen before, and both films have now been reissued on DVD. And Robert Drew now joins us from New York. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you.
These two films are glimpses of John F. Kennedy and the people around him like no other glimpses of this man we're all thinking about so much this week on the 40th anniversary of his assassination. Before we talk about the films, let's hear a cut from Primary, which is a film about Kennedy's primary race against Hubert Humphrey in 1960.
Ladies and gentlemen, I first of all want to express my appreciation to all of you. I know you've been standing for quite a few minutes. So I can see
I've been standing for 3 months, so I know how tough it is.
What you're hearing there, Robert, of course, is the charismatic John F. Kennedy. Throughout this film primary, people flocked to him, didn't they?
Yes, they did. One of his problems was that children loved him so much that they got in the way of the adults, and children can't vote. He could always turn something into a laugh, the way you just heard him charm a crowd there in 1 minute and 30 seconds.
Robert, was it difficult at all to get Kennedy and Humphrey to cooperate with a camera much more in their face than was ever the case before?
We were going to do something that had never been done before. It would be a new form of reporting, a new form of journalism. And for it to work, the camera and recorder would have to be with Kennedy for a day and night for 5 days. And he thought that over and asked a few questions. And finally he said, are you out to get me? Not in those words, but that was the question.
Yeah.
And I said, no, I'm going to edit this film fairly. And for this to work at all, you'll have to trust me.
And he
said, if I don't call you tomorrow, we're on.
And he didn't call.
He didn't call.
Great. Now, the second film that's been re-released on DVD now is called Crisis, Behind a Presidential Commitment. Again, the access there is extraordinary. This is a film about John F. Kennedy at a time when they were trying to integrate the University of Alabama. Governor George C. Wallace was trying to prevent that. And you got inside the White House as Kennedy and his administration, his attorney general, his brother, were making decisions. Let's hear a moment from that filming in the Oval Office during a strategy session with John F. Kennedy.
And if he still refuses, then Nick Katzenbach will say that we got this court order and we have to go through on a legal basis. He made the test. This matter should be determined in the courts. It shouldn't be determined out here. He's had his opportunity and should let him go through, or otherwise we're going to have to take other steps because these students are going to attend the University of Alabama. Then if he still doesn't move, then we'll try to get by him.
Pushing?
So I push him a little bit. Having
trying to walk around
him and try to walk through. There's three doors. We're going to try to have somebody inside who will open up one of the other doors so that we can't cover all three doors and just have the girls and the boys just try to go through another door. Anyway, that's going to be up to Nick Katzenbach as to how far we can go in that.
John F. Kennedy, his brother Bobby, talking about Nicholas Katzenbach, the deputy attorney general, who was charged with bringing two black students into the University of Alabama at a doorway that Governor George C. Wallace of Alabama planned to block. Why do you think there's never been access like that again? This was candid, off-the-cuff decision-making in the Oval Office, and it's never been filmed again. Why do you think?
Kennedy took a lot of heat for giving us a favorite position inside the White House. But Kennedy was smart by having me shoot a test in the White House first. He found out that he could forget the camera completely. And during a Joint Chiefs of Staff meeting, the subject turned to Cuba, which they hadn't invaded yet. The general had to turn to Kennedy and point to us to remind him that a camera was on him. And Kennedy turned to me and grinned. And I understood and why and left.
Anyone who's read their history knows how those days at the University of Alabama turned out. And yet this is a very suspenseful film because you feel the tension as decisions had to be made about the Alabama National Guard and how to handle Governor George Wallace in Alabama. The film's climax is a speech Kennedy gave to the nation the night the University of Alabama was finally integrated.
If an American, because his skin is dark, cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place? Who among us would then be content with the counsels of patience and delay? 100 years of delay have passed since President Lincoln freed the slaves, yet their heirs, their grandsons, are not fully free. They are not yet freed from the bonds of injustice. They are not yet freed from social and economic oppression. And this nation, for all its hopes and all its boasts, will not be fully free until all its citizens are free.
Such deeply personal documents about the Kennedys, as well as historic Jacqueline Kennedy on the campaign trail in Wisconsin, just glistening like a movie star amid these farmers and Midwesterners. Bobby Kennedy shown in his office as Attorney General, his children running through the office. You must have felt John F. Kennedy's assassination in a particular way, Robert. Where were you, and what are your memories of that?
I was on 6th Avenue looking in a cigar store window. I never look in windows, and I don't smoke. But there was a tinny microphone overhead saying, reporting that Kennedy had been shot. I went back to the office, and I got a call from Elmer Auer, president of ABC News, saying, go to Washington and shoot the funeral. Make a film. What kind of film? He said, your kind of film, and hung up. And I decided not to shoot what the other cameras, there were millions of cameras there, would shoot, but to shoot backward at the faces of the people lining the parade route and at the casket. And my kind of film turned out to be a 12-minute film without narration on the faces of people at the funeral.
Which is included on the new DVD release of Crisis, Behind a Presidential Commitment. The other DVD of Robert Drew's work, now released, is Primary. Robert Drew, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, as we just mentioned, it was 40 years ago this week President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. This is Bill Downs of ABC News reporting from Arlington National Cemetery as the president's body was laid to rest.
And now, up Sheridan Drive. Two limousines, and the caisson is now coming into view on Sheridan Drive. The leader on that dapple gray horse, the six other gray horses, the guard around the caisson. We can see the brilliant white and red stripes of the flag.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
We'll meet Priscilla McMillan, said to be the only person who knew both John F. Kennedy and Lee Harvey Oswald.
And we review the new Halle Berry thriller, Gothica.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.